of ultra-agriculture would be, if one were suggested. If, on the other hand, we are discussing the purely economic conditions of the epoch of finance capital as a historically concrete epoch in the 20th century, the best reply that one can make to lifeless abstractions of ultra-imperialism, which serve an exclusively reactionary aim, viz. That of diverting attention from the depth of existing antagonisms, is to contrast them with the concrete economic realities of present-day world economy. Kautsky's meaningless talk about ultra-imperialism encourages, among other things, that profoundly mistaken idea which only brings grist to the mill of the apologists of imperialism, viz. That the domination of finance capital lessens the unevenness and contradictions inherent in world economy, whereas, in reality, it increases them. Richard Kallwer, in his little book, An Introduction to World Economics, attempted to compile the main, purely economic data required to depict in a concrete way the internal relations of world economy at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. He divides the world into five main economic areas as follows. 1. Central Europe, the whole of Europe with the exception of Russia and Great Britain. 2. Great Britain. 3. Russia. 4. Eastern Asia. 5. America. He includes the colonies in the areas of the state to which they belong and leaves out a few countries not distributed according to areas, such as Persia, Afghanistan, and Arabia in Asia, Morocco and Abyssinia in Africa, etc. Here is a brief summary of the economic data he quotes on these regions. Principal economic area, 1. Central European, area in millions of square miles, 27.6, 23.6 of which is in colonies. Population in millions, 388, 146 of which is in colonies. Railways, 1,000 kilometers, 204. Mercantile fleet, million tons, 8. Trade, import and export, billion marks, 41. Output of coal in millions, 251. Output of pig iron in million tons, 15. Number of cotton spindles in millions, 26. Principal economic area 2, British. Area in millions of square miles, 28.9, 28.6 in colonies. Population in millions, 398, 355 in colonies. Railways in thousands of kilometers, 140. Mercantile fleet in millions of tons, 11. Import and export in billions of marks, 25. Output of coal in millions of tons, 249. Output of pig iron in millions of tons, 9. Number of cotton spindles in millions, 51. Principal economic area 3, Russian. Area in millions of square miles, 22. Population in millions, 131. Railways in thousands of kilometers, 63. Mercantile fleet in millions of tons, 1. Trade, import and export in billions of marks, 3. Output of coal in millions of tons, 16. Output of pig iron in millions of tons, 3. Number of cotton spindles in millions, 7. Principal economic area 4, East Asian. Area in millions of square miles, 12. Population in millions, 389. Railways in thousands of kilometers, 8. Mercantile fleet in millions of tons, 1. Import and export in billions of marks, 2. Output of coal in millions of tons, 8. Output of pig iron in millions of tons, 0.02. Number of cotton spindles in millions, 2. Principal economic area number 5, American. Area in millions of square miles, 30. Population in millions, 148. Railways in thousands of kilometers, 379. Mercantile fleet in millions of tons, 6. Import and export in billions of marks, 14. Output of coal in millions of tons, 245. Output of pig iron in millions of tons, 14. Number of cotton spindles in millions, 19. We notice three areas of highly developed capitalism, that is, with a high development of means of transport, of trade, and of industry. These are the Central European, the British, and the American areas. Among these are three states which dominate the world: Germany, Great Britain, the United States. Imperialist rivalry and the struggle between these countries have become very keen because Germany has only a restricted area and a few colonies. The creation of Central Europe is still a matter for the future. It is being born in the midst of desperate struggles. For the moment, the distinctive feature of Europe is political disintegration. In the British and American areas, on the other hand, political concentration is highly developed, but there is a tremendous disparity between the immense colonies of one and the insignificant colonies of the other. In the colonies, capitalism is only beginning to develop. The struggle for South America is becoming more and more acute. There are two areas where capitalism is not strongly developed: Russia and Eastern Asia. In the former, the density of the population is very small. In the latter, it is very high. In the former, political concentration is very high. In the latter, it does not exist. The partition of China is only beginning, and the struggle between Japan, USA, etc. in connection therewith is steadily gaining in intensity. Compare this reality, the vast diversity of economic and political conditions, the extreme disparity in the rate of development of the various countries, and the violent struggles of the imperialist states, with Kautsky's stupid little fable about peaceful ultra-imperialism. Is this not the reactionary attempt of a frightened Philistine to hide from stern reality? Do not the international cartels, which Kautsky imagines are the embryos of ultra-imperialism, with as much reason as one would have for describing the manufacture of tabloids in a laboratory as ultra-agriculture in embryo, present an example of the division and the redivision of the world, the transition from peaceful division to violent division, and vice versa? Is not American and other finance capital, which divide the whole world peacefully, with Germany's participation, for example, in the International Rail Syndicate or in the International Mercantile Shipping Trust, now engaged in redividing the world on the basis of a new relation of forces which has been changed by methods by no means peaceful? Finance capital and the trusts are aggravating instead of diminishing the differences in the rate of development of the various parts of world economy. When the relation of forces is highly developed, but there is a tremendous disparity, contradictions be found, except by resorting to violence? Railway statistics provide remarkably exact data on the different rates of development of capitalism and finance capital in world economy. In the last decades of imperialist development, the total length of railways, expressed in thousands of kilometers, has changed as follows. In 1890, Europe 224, USA 228, colonies total 82, independent or semi-independent states of Asia and America 43, for a total of 617, the colonies and independent or semi-independent states of Asia and America totaling 125 of that. In 1913, Europe 346, USA 411, colonies total 210, independent or semi-independent states of Asia and America 137, totaling 1,104. The colonies and independent or semi-independent states of Asia and America, totaling 347. This means an increase from 1890 to 1913 in Europe of 122, USA 143, colonies total 128, independent or semi-independent states of Asia and America 94, the colonies and independent or semi-independent states totaling 222. Thus, the development of railways has been more rapid in the colonies and in the independent or semi-independent states of Asia and America. Here, as we know, the finance capital of the four or five biggest capitalist states reigns undisputed. 200,000 kilometers of new railways in the colonies and in the other countries of Asia and America represent more than 40 billion marks in capital, newly invested under particularly advantageous conditions, with special guarantees of a good return, and with profitable orders for steelworks, etc., etc. Capitalism is growing with the greatest rapidity in the colonies and in transoceanic countries. Among the latter, new imperialist powers are emerging, e.g. Japan. The struggle of world imperialism is becoming aggravated. The tribute levied by finance capital on the most profitable colonial and transoceanic enterprises is increasing. In sharing out this booty, an exceptionally large part goes to countries which, as far as the development of productive forces is concerned, do not always stand at the top of the list. In the case of the biggest countries, considered with their colonies, the total length of railways was as follows, in thousands of kilometers. 1890, USA 268, British Empire 107, Russia 32, Germany 43, France 41, total 491. 1913, USA 413, British 208, Russia 78, Germany 68, France 63, for an increase of USA 145, British Empire 101, Russia 46, Germany 25, and France 22, a total increase of 339. Thus, about 80% of the total existing railways are concentrated in the hands of the five great powers. But the concentration of the ownership of these railways, that of finance capital, is much greater still. French and English millionaires, for example, own an enormous amount of stocks and bonds in American, Russian, and other railways. Thanks to her colonies, Great Britain has increased her length of railways by 100,000 kilometers, four times as much as Germany. And yet it is well known that the development of productive forces in Germany, and especially the development of the coal and iron industries, has been much more rapid during this period than in England, not to mention France and Russia. In 1892, Germany produced 4,900,000 tons of pig iron, and Great Britain produced 6,800,000 tons. In 1912, Germany produced 17,600 tons, and Great Britain 9 million tons. Germany, therefore, has an overwhelming superiority over England in this respect. We ask, is there, under capitalism, any means of remedying the disparity between the development of productive forces and the accumulation of capital on the one side, and the division of colonies and spheres of influence by finance capital on the other side, other than by resorting to war? Chapter 8, The Parasitism and Decay of Capitalism. We have yet to examine another very important aspect of imperialism to which, usually, too little importance is attached in the most common of arguments on the subject. One of the shortcomings of the Marxist, Hilferding, is that he takes a step backward compared with the non-Marxist, Hobson. We refer to parasitism, which is a feature of imperialism. As we have seen, the most deep-rooted economic foundation of imperialism is monopoly. This is capitalist monopoly, i.e., monopoly which has grown out of capitalism and exists in the general capitalist environment of commodity production and competition, and remains in permanent and insoluble contradiction to this general environment. Nevertheless, like all monopoly, this capitalist monopoly inevitably gives rise to a tendency to stagnation and decay. As monopoly prices become fixed, even temporarily, the stimulus to technical and, consequently, to all progress disappears to a certain extent, and to that extent also, the economic possibility arises of deliberately retarding technical progress. For instance, in America, a certain Mr. Owens invented a machine which revolutionized the manufacture of bottles. The German Bottle Manufacturing Trust purchased Owens' patent, but refrained from utilizing it. Certainly, monopoly cannot, under capitalism, eliminate competition in the world market completely and for a long period of time. And this, by the by, is one of the reasons why the theory of ultra-imperialism is so absurd. Certainly, the possibility of reducing cost of production and increasing profits by introducing technical improvements is an influence in the direction of change. Nevertheless, the tendency to stagnation and decay, which is the feature of monopoly, continues, and in certain branches of industry, in certain countries, for certain periods of time, it becomes predominant. The monopoly of ownership of very extensive, rich, or well-situated colonies operates in the same direction. Moreover, imperialism is an immense accumulation of money capital in a few countries, which, as we have seen, amounts to 100 to 150 billion francs in various securities. Hence, the extraordinary growth of the class, or rather of the category of bondholders, rentiers, people who live by clipping coupons, who take no part whatever in production, whose profession is idleness. The export of capital, one of the essential economic bases of imperialism, still more completely isolates the rentiers from production and sets the seals of parasitism on the whole country that lives by the exploitation of the labor of several overseas countries and colonies. In 1893, writes Hobson, the British capital invested abroad represented about 15% of the total wealth of the United Kingdom. Let us remember that by 1915, this capital had increased about 2.5 times. Aggressive imperialism, says Hobson further on, which costs the taxpayer so dear, which is of so little value to the manufacturer and the trader, is a source of great gain to the investor. The annual income Great Britain derives from commissions in her whole foreign and colonial trade, import and export, is estimated by Sir R. Giffen at £18 million for 1899, taken at 2.5% upon a turnover of £800 million. Great as this sum is, it does not explain the aggressive imperialism of Great Britain. This is explained by the £90 to £100 million sterling revenue from invested capital, the income of the rentier class. The revenue of the bondholders is 5 times greater than the revenue obtained from the foreign trade of the greatest trading country in the world. This is the essence of imperialism and imperialist parasitism. For that reason, the term bondholder state, Rentnerstaat, or usurer state, is passing into current use in the economic literature that deals with imperialism. The world has become divided into a handful of money-lending states on the one side and a vast majority of debtor states on the other. The premier place among foreign investments, says Shule's Governance, is held by those placed in politically dependent or closely allied countries. Great Britain grants loans to Egypt, Japan, China, and South America. Her navy plays the part of bailiff in the case of necessity. Great Britain's political power protects her from the indignation of her debtors. Sartorius von Waltershausen, in his work, The Economic System of Foreign Investments, cites Holland as the model bondholder state and points out that Great Britain and France have taken the same road. Schilder believes that 5 industrial nations have become pronounced creditor nations: Great Britain, France, Germany, Belgium, and Switzerland. Holland does not appear on this list simply because it is industrially less developed. He asserts that the United States is creditor only of the other American countries. Great Britain, says Shule's Governance, is gradually becoming transformed from an industrial state to a creditor state. Notwithstanding the absolute increase in industrial output and the export of manufactured goods, the relative importance of income from interest and dividends, issues, commissions, and speculation is on the increase for the whole of the national economy. In my opinion, it is precisely this that forms the economic basis of imperialist ascendancy. The creditor is more permanently attached to the debtor than the seller is to the buyer. In regard to Germany, A. Landsberg, the editor of D. Bank, in 1911, in an article entitled "Germany is a Bondholder State," wrote the following. People in Germany are ready to sneer at the yearning observed in France of people to become rentiers. But they forget that as far as the middle class is concerned, the situation in Germany is becoming more and more like that in France. The rentier state is a state of parasitic decaying capitalism, and this circumstance cannot fail to influence all the social political conditions of the countries affected generally, and the 2 fundamental trends of the working class movement particularly. To demonstrate this in the clearest manner possible, we will quote Hobson, who will be regarded as a more reliable witness, since he cannot be suspected of leanings towards orthodox Marxism. Moreover, he is an Englishman who is very well acquainted with the situation in the country which is richest in colonies, in finance capital, and in imperialist experience. With the Boer War fresh in his mind, Hobson describes the connection between imperialism and the interests of the financiers, the growing profit from war contracts, etc., and writes as follows. While the directors of this definitely parasitic policy are capitalists, the same motives appeal to special classes of the workers. In many towns, most important trades are dependent upon government employment or contracts. The imperialism of the metal and shipbuilding centers is attributable in no small degree to this fact. In this writer's opinion, there are 2 causes which weakened the older empires. 1, economic parasitism, and 2, the formation of armies composed of subject races. There is first the habit of economic parasitism, by which the ruling state has used its provinces, colonies, and dependencies in order to enrich its ruling class and to bribe its lower classes into acquiescence. And we would add that the economic possibility of such corruption, whatever its form may be, requires high monopolist profits. As for the second cause, Hobson writes, "One of the strangest symptoms of the blindness of imperialism is the reckless indifference with which Great Britain, France, and other imperialist nations are embarking on this perilous dependence. Great Britain has gone farthest. Most of the fighting by which we have won our Indian Empire has been done by the natives. In India, as more recently in Egypt, great standing armies are placed under British commanders. Almost all the fighting associated with our African dominions, except in the southern part, has been done for us by natives." Hobson gives the following economic appraisal of the prospect of the partition of China. "The greater part of Western Europe might then assume the appearance and character already established by tracts of country in the south of England, in the Riviera, and in the tourist-ridden or residential parts of Italy and Switzerland, little clusters of wealthy aristocrats drawing dividends and pensions from the Far East, with a somewhat larger group of professional retainers and tradesmen, and a large body of personal servants and workers in the transport trade and in the final stages of production of the more perishable goods. All the main arterial industries would have disappeared, the staple foods and manufactures flowing in as tribute from Asia and Africa. We have foreshadowed the possibility of even a larger alliance of Western states, a European federation of great powers which, so far from forwarding the cause of world civilization, might introduce the gigantic peril of a Western parasitism, a group of advanced industrial nations whose upper classes draw vast tribute from Asia and Africa, with which they support great tame masses of retainers, no longer engaged in the staple industries of agriculture and manufacture, but kept in the performance of personal or minor industrial services under the control of a new financial aristocracy. Let those who would scout such a theory as undeserving of consideration examine the economic and social condition of districts in southern England today, which are already reduced to this condition, and reflect upon the vast extension of such a system which might be rendered feasible by the subjection of China to the economic control of similar groups of financiers, investors, and political and business officials, draining the greatest potential reservoir of profit the world has ever known in order to consume it in Europe. The situation is far too complex, the play of world forces far too incalculable, to render this or any other single interpretation of the future very probable. But the influences which govern the imperialism of Western Europe today are moving in this direction, and, unless counteracted or diverted, make towards some such consummation. Hobson is quite right. Unless the forces of imperialism are counteracted, they will lead to what he has described. He correctly appraises the significance of a United States of Europe in the present conditions of imperialism. He should have added, however, that even within the working class movement, the opportunists, who are for the moment predominant in most countries, are working systematically and undeviatingly in this very direction. Imperialism, which means the partition of the world and the exploitation of other countries besides China, which means high monopoly profits for a handful of very rich countries, creates the economic possibility of corrupting the upper strata of the proletariat, and thereby fosters, gives form to, and strengthens opportunism. However, we must not lose sight of the forces which counteract imperialism generally, and opportunism particularly, which, naturally, the social liberal Hobson is unable to perceive. The German opportunist, Gerhard Hildebrand, who was expelled from the party for defending imperialism, and would today make an excellent leader of the so-called Socialist Democratic Party of Germany, serves as a good supplement to Hobson by his advocacy of a United States of Western Europe without Russia, for the purpose of joint action against the African Negroes, against the Great Islamic Movement, for the upkeep of a powerful army and native, against a Sino-Japanese coalition, etc. The description of British imperialism in Shule's Gavernitz's book reveals the same parasitical traits. The national income of Great Britain approximately doubled from 1865 to 1898, while the income from overseas increased ninefold in the same period. While the merit of imperialism is that it trains the Negroes to habits of industry, not without coercion, of course, the danger of imperialism is that Europe will shift the burden of physical toil, first agricultural and mining, and then the more arduous toil in industry, onto the colored races and itself be content with the role of rentier, and in this way, perhaps, pave the way for the economic and later the political emancipation of the colored races. An increasing proportion of land in Great Britain is being taken out of cultivation and used for sport, for the diversion of the rich. Scotland, says Shules Gavernitz, is the most aristocratic playground in the world. It lives on its past and on Mr. Carnegie. Great Britain annually spends £14 million on horse racing and fox hunting. The number of bondholders in Great Britain has risen to about 1 million. The percentage of producers among the total population is becoming smaller. Year 1851. Population in millions, 17.9. Number of workers employed in basic industry in millions, 4.1. Percent of producers to total population, 23. Year 1901. Population in millions, 32.5. Number of workers employed in basic industry in millions, 4.9. Percent of producers to total population, 15. And speaking of the British working class, the bourgeois student of British imperialism at the beginning of the 20th century is obliged to distinguish systematically between the upper stratum of workers and the lower stratum of the proletariat proper. The upper stratum furnishes the main body of cooperators, of trade unionists, of members of sporting clubs, and of numerous religious sects. The electoral system, which in Great Britain is still sufficiently restricted to exclude the lower stratum of the proletariat proper, is adapted to their level. In order to present the condition of the British working class in the best possible light, only this upper stratum, which constitutes only a minority of the proletariat, is generally spoken of. For instance, the problem of unemployment is mainly a London problem and that of the lower proletarian stratum, which is of little political movement. It would be better to say, which is of little political movement for the bourgeois politicians and the socialist opportunists. Another special feature of imperialism, which is connected with the facts we are describing, is the decline in emigration from imperialist countries and the increase in immigration to those countries from the backward countries where low wages are paid. As Hobson observes, emigration from Great Britain has been declining since 1894. In that year, the number of emigrants from Great Britain was 242,000, while in 1900, the number was only 169,000. German emigration reached the highest point between 1880 and 1890, with a total of 1,453,000 emigrants. In the course of the following two decades, it fell to 544,000 and even to 341,000. On the other hand, there was an increase in the number of workers entering Germany from Austria, Italy, Russia, and other countries. According to the 1907 census, there were 1,342,294 foreigners in Germany, of whom 440,800 were industrial workers and 257,329 were agricultural workers. In France, the workers employed in the mining industry are, in great part, foreigners, Polish, Italian, and Spanish. In the United States, immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe are engaged in the most poorly paid occupations, while American workers provide the highest percentage of overseers, or of the better paid workers. Imperialism has the tendency of creating privileged sections even among the workers, and of detaching them from the main proletarian masses. It must be observed that in Great Britain, the tendency of imperialism to divide the workers in this way, to encourage opportunism among them, and cause temporary decay in the working class movement, revealed itself much earlier than the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries, for two important features of imperialism were observed in Great Britain in the middle of the 19th century, viz. Vast colonial possessions and a monopolist position in world markets. Marx and Engels systematically trace this relation between opportunism in the labor movement and the imperialistic features of British capitalism for several decades. For example, on October 7, 1858, Engels wrote to Marx, "The English proletariat is becoming more and more bourgeois, so that this most bourgeois of all nations is apparently aiming ultimately at the possession of a bourgeois economy and a bourgeois proletariat as well as a bourgeoisie. For a nation which exploits the whole world, this is, of course, to a certain extent, justifiable." Almost a quarter of a century later, In a letter dated August 11, 1881, Engels speaks of the worst type of British trade units which allow themselves to be led by men who have been bought by the capitalists, or at least are in their pay. In a letter to Kautsky, dated September 12, 1882, Engels wrote, "You ask me what the English workers think about colonial policy. Well, exactly the same as they think about politics in general. The same as what the bourgeois think. There is no workers' party here, there is only conservatives and liberal radicals, and the workers gaily share the feast of England's monopoly of the world market and the colonies." Engels expressed similar ideas in the press in his preface to the second edition of The Condition of the Working Class in England, which appeared in 1892. We thus see clearly the causes and effects. The causes are, 1. Exploitation of the whole world by this country. 2. Its monopolistic position in the world market. 3. Its colonial monopoly. The effects are, 1. A section of the British proletariat becomes bourgeois. 2. A section of the proletariat permits itself to be led by people who are bought by the bourgeoisie, or at least, who are in their pay. The imperialism of the beginning of the 20th century completed the partition of the world among a very few states, each of which today exploits, i.e., draws super profits from, a part of the world only a little smaller than that which England exploited in 1858. Each of them, by means of trusts, cartels, finance capital, and debtor and creditor relations, occupies a monopoly position on the world market. Each of them enjoys to some degree a colonial monopoly. We have seen that out of the total of 75 million square kilometers, which comprise the whole colonial world, 65 million square kilometers, or 86%, belongs to six great powers. 61 million square kilometers, or 81%, belong to three powers. The distinctive feature of the present situation is the prevalence of economic and political conditions which could not but increase the irreconcilability between opportunism and the general and vital interests of the working class movement. Embryonic imperialism has grown into a dominant system. Capitalist monopolies occupy first place in economics and politics. The division of the world has been completed. On the other hand, instead of an undisputed monopoly by Great Britain, we see a few imperialist powers disputing among themselves for the right to share in this monopoly, and this struggle is characteristic of the whole period of the beginning of the 20th century. Opportunism, therefore, cannot now triumph in the working class movement of any country for decades as it did in England in the second half of the 19th century. But in a number of countries, it has grown ripe, overripe, and rotten, and has become completely merged with bourgeois policy in the form of social chauvinism. Chapter 9. The Critique of Imperialism. By the critique of imperialism, in the broad sense of the term, we mean the attitude towards imperialist policy of the different classes of society as part of their general ideology. The enormous dimensions of finance capital concentrated in a few hands, and creating an extremely extensive and close network of ties and relationships which subordinate not only the small and medium, but also even the very small capitalists and small masters, on one hand, and the intense struggle waged against other national state groups of financiers for the partition of the world and the power to rule over other countries, on the other hand, caused the wholesale transition of the possessing classes to the side of imperialism. The signs of the times are a general enthusiasm regarding its prospects, a passionate defense of imperialism, and every possible embellishment of its real nature. The imperialist ideology also permeates the working class. There is no Chinese wall between it and the other classes. The leaders of the so-called Social Democratic Party of Germany are today justly called social imperialists, that is, socialists in words and imperialists in deeds. But as early as 1902, Hobson noted the existence of Fabian imperialists, who belonged to the opportunist Fabian Society in England. The bourgeois scholars and publicists usually come out in defense of imperialism in a somewhat veiled form and obscure its complete domination and its profound roots. They strive to concentrate attention on details and secondary characteristics, and do their very best to distract attention from the main issue by means of ridiculous schemes for reform, such as police supervision of the trusts and banks, etc. Less frequently, Cynical and frank imperialists speak out and are bold enough to admit the absurdity of the idea of reforming the fundamental features of imperialism. We will give an example. The German imperialists' attempt, in the magazine Archives of World Economy, to follow the movements for national emancipation in the colonies, particularly, of course, in colonies other than those belonging to Germany. They note the ferment and protest movements in India, the movement in Natal in South Africa, the movements in the Dutch East Indies, etc. One of them, commenting on an English report of the speeches delivered at a conference of subject peoples and races, held June 28th through 30th, 1910, at which representatives of various peoples subject to foreign domination in Africa, Asia, and Europe were present, writes as follows in appraising the speeches delivered at this conference. "We are told that we must fight against imperialism, that the dominant states must recognize the right of subject peoples to home rule, that an international tribunal should supervise the fulfillment of treaties concluded between the great powers and weak peoples. One does not get any further than the expression of these pious wishes. We see no trace of understanding of the fact that imperialism is indissolubly bound with capitalism in its present form, and therefore, also no trace of the realization that an open struggle against imperialism would be hopeless unless, perhaps, the fight is confined to protests against certain of its especially abhorrent excesses. Since the reform of the basis of imperialism is a deception, a pious wish since the bourgeois representatives of oppressed nations go no further forward, the bourgeois representatives of the opposing nation go further backward to servility towards imperialism, concealed by the cloak of science, logic indeed. The question as to whether it is possible to reform the basis of imperialism, whether to go forward to the aggravation of the antagonisms which it engenders, or backwards, towards allaying these antagonisms, is a fundamental question in the critique of imperialism. As a consequence of the fact that the political features of imperialism are reaction all along the line, and increased national oppression, resulting from the oppression of the financial oligarchy and the elimination of free competition, a democratic petty bourgeois opposition has been rising against imperialism in almost all imperialist countries since the beginning of the 20th century. And the desertion of Kautsky and of the broad international Kautskyan trend from Marxism is displayed in the very fact that Kautsky not only did not trouble to oppose, not only was not able to oppose this petty bourgeois reformist opposition, which is really reactionary with its economic basis, but in practice, actually became merged with it. In the United States, the imperialist war waged against Spain in 1898 stirred up the opposition of the anti-imperialists, the last of the Mohicans of bourgeois democracy. They declared this war to be criminal, denounced the annexation of foreign territories as being a violation of the Constitution, and denounced the Jingo treachery, by means of which Aguinaldo, leader of the native Filipinos, was deceived. The Americans promised him the independence of his country, but later they landed troops and annexed it. They quoted the words of Lincoln. "When the white man governs himself, that is self-government. But when he governs himself and also governs others, it is no longer self-government, it is despotism." While all this criticism shrank from recognizing the indissoluble bond between imperialism and the trusts, and, therefore, between imperialism and the very foundations of capitalism, while it shrank from joining up with the forces endangered by large-scale capitalism in its development, it remained a pious wish. This is also, in the main, the attitude of Hobson in his criticism of imperialism. Hobson anticipated Kautsky in protesting against the inevitability of imperialism, and in calling for the need to raise the consuming capacity of the people under capitalism. The petty bourgeois point of view in the critique of imperialism, the domination of the banks, the financial oligarchy, etc., is that adopted by the authors we have often quoted, such as Agade A. Landsberg, L. Eschwege, and among French writers, Victor Bérard, author of a superficial book entitled England and Imperialism, which appeared in 1900. All these authors, who make no claims to being Marxists, contrast imperialism with free competition and democracy. They condemn the Baghdad Railway scheme as leading to disputes and war, utter pious wishes for peace, etc. This applies also to the compiler of International Stock and Share Issue Statistics, ANAMARC, who, after calculating the hundreds of billions of francs representing international values, exclaimed in 1912, "Is it possible to believe that the peace can be disturbed? That, in the face of these enormous figures, anyone would risk starting a war?" Such simplicity of mind on the part of the bourgeois economists is not surprising. Besides, it is in their best interests to pretend to be so naive and talk seriously about peace under imperialism. But what remains of Kautsky's Marxism when in 1914, 15, and 16, he takes up the same attitude as the bourgeois reformists and affirms that everybody is agreed, imperialists, pseudo-socialists, and social pacifists, as regards peace? Instead of an analysis of imperialism and an exposure of the depths of its contradictions, we have nothing but a reformist pious wish to wave it aside, to evade it. Here is an example of Kautsky's economic criticism of imperialism. He takes the statistics of British import and export trade with Egypt for 1872 and 1912. These statistics show that this import and export trade has developed more slowly than British foreign trade as a whole. From this, Kautsky concludes, "We have no reason to suppose that British trade with Egypt would have been less developed as a result of the mere operation of economic factors without military occupation. The urge of the present-day states to expand can be best satisfied not by the violent methods of imperialism, but by peaceful democracy." This argument, which is repeated in every key by Kautsky's armor-bearer and the Russian protector of social chauvinists, Mr. Spectator, forms the basis of Kautskyan criticism of imperialism, and that's why we must deal with it in greater detail. We will begin with a quotation from Hilferding, whose conclusions, as Kautsky on many occasions, and notably in April 1915, declared, have been unanimously adopted by all socialist theoreticians. "It is not the business of the proletariat," writes Hilferding, "to contrast the more progressive capitalist policy to that of the now bygone era, of free trade and of hostility towards the state. The reply of the proletariat to the economic policy of finance capital, to imperialism, cannot be free trade, but socialism. The aim of the proletarian policy cannot now be the ideal of restoring free competition, which has now become a reactionary ideal, but the complete abolition of competition by the abolition of capitalism." Kautsky departed from Marxism by advocating what is, in the period of finance capital, a reactionary ideal. Peaceful democracy, the mere operation of economic factors, etc. For objectively, this ideal drags us back from monopoly capitalism to the non-monopolist stage and is a reformist swindle. Trade with Europe or any other colony or semi-colony would have been better developed without military occupation, without imperialism, and without finance capital. What does this mean? That capitalism would develop more rapidly if free competition were not restricted by monopolies in general, by the connections or the yoke, i.e., the monopoly, of finance capital, or by the monopolist possession of colonies by certain countries? Kautsky's argument can have no other meaning, and this meaning is meaningless. But suppose, for the sake of argument, free competition, without any sort of monopoly, would develop capitalism and trade more rapidly. Is it not a fact that the more rapidly trade and capitalism develop, the greater is the concentration of production and capital which gives rise to monopoly? And monopolies have already come into being, precisely out of free competition. Even if monopolies have now begun to retard progress, it is not an argument in favor of free competition, which has become impossible since it gave rise to monopoly. Whichever way one turns Kautsky's argument, one will find nothing in it except reaction and bourgeois reformism. Even if we modify this argument and say, as Spectator says, that the trade of the British colonies with the mother country is now developing more slowly, that the trade of the British colonies with the mother country is now developing more slowly than their trade with other countries, it does not save Kautsky, for it is also monopoly and imperialism that is beating Great Britain. Only it is the monopoly and imperialism of another country, America, Germany. It is known that the cartels have given rise to a new and peculiar form of protective tariff. Goods suitable for export are protected. Engels noted this in Volume 3 of Capital. It is known, too, that the cartels in finance capital have a system peculiar to themselves, that of exporting goods at dumping prices, or dumping, as the English call it. Within a given country, the cartel sells its goods at a high price fixed by monopoly. Abroad, it sells them at a much lower price to undercut the competitor, to enlarge its own production to the utmost, etc. If German trade with the British colonies is developing more rapidly than that of Great Britain with the same colonies, it only proves that German imperialism is younger, stronger, and better organized than British imperialism, is superior to it. But this by no means proves the superiority of free trade, for it is not free trade fighting against protection and colonial dependence, but two rival imperialisms, two monopolies, two groups of finance capital. The superiority of German imperialism over British imperialism is stronger than the wall of colonial frontiers or of protective tariffs. To use this as an argument in favor of free trade and peaceful democracy is banality, is to forget the essential features and qualities of imperialism, to substitute petty bourgeois reformism for Marxism. It is interesting to note that even the bourgeois economist, A. Landsberg, whose criticism of imperialism is as petty bourgeois as Kautsky's, nevertheless got closer to a more scientific study of commercial statistics. He did not compare merely one country chosen at random, and a colony, with the other countries. He examined the export trade of an imperialist country. 1. With countries which are financially dependent upon it, which borrow money from it, and 2. With countries which are financially independent. He obtained the following results. Export trade of Germany in millions of marks. Countries financially dependent on Germany. Romania, 1889, 48.2. 1908, 70.8. Percentage of increase, 47. Portugal, 1889, 19.0. 1908, 32.8. Percentage of increase, 73. Argentina, 1889, 60.7, 1908, 147.0, percentage of increase, 143. Brazil, 1889, 48.7, 1908, 84.5, percentage of increase, 73. Chile, 1889, 28.3, 1908, 52.4. Percentage of increase, 85. Turkey, 1889, 29.9. 1908, 64.0. Percentage of increase, 114. Totaling, 1889, 234.8. 1908, 451.5. Percentage of increase, 92. Countries financially independent of Germany. Great Britain, 1889, 651.8, 1908, 997.4, percentage of increase, 53. France, 1889, 210.2, 1908, 437.9, percentage of increase, 108. Belgium, 1889, 137.2, 1908, 437.9. Percentage of increase, 108. Belgium, 1889, 137.2. 1908, 322.8. Percentage of increase, 135. Switzerland, 1889, 177.4. 1908, 401.1. Percentage of increase, 127. Australia, 1889, 21.2, 1908, 64.5, percentage of increase, 205. Dutch East Indies, 1889, 8.8, 1908, 40.7, percentage of increase, 363. Total, 1889, 1206.6. 1908, 2264.4. Percentage of increase, 87. Lansberg did not add up the columns, and therefore, strangely enough, failed to observe that if the figures prove anything at all, they prove that he is wrong. For the exports to countries financially dependent on Germany have grown more rapidly, if only slightly, than those to the countries which are financially independent. We emphasize the if, for Lansberg's figures are far from complete. On the relation between export trade and loans, Lansberg wrote, "In 1890-91, a Romanian loan was floated through the German banks which had already in previous years made advances on this loan. The loan was used chiefly for purchases by Romania of railway material in Germany. In 1891, German exports to Romania amounted to 55 million marks. The following year, they fell to 39,400,000 marks, then, with fluctuations, to 25,400,000 in 1900. Only in very recent years have they regained the level of 1891, thanks to a few new loans. German exports to Portugal rose, following the loans of 1888-89, to 21 million, 1890, and then fell in the following 2 years to 16,200,000 and 7,400,000, and only regained their former level in 1903. German trade with the Argentine is still more striking. Following the loans floated in 1888 and 1890, German exports to the Argentine reached, in 1889, 60,700,000 marks. 2 years later, they only reached 18,600,000 marks, that is to say, less than one-third of the previous figures. It was not until 1901 that they regained and surpassed the level of 1889, and then only as a result of new loans floated by the state and by municipalities with advances to build power stations and with other credit operations. As for Chile, exports to that country rose to 45,200,000 marks in 1892 after the loan negotiated in 1889. The following year they fell to 22,500,000 marks. A new Chilean loan floated by the German banks in 1906 was followed by a rise of exports in 1907 to 84,700,000 marks, only to fall again to 52,400 marks in 1908. From all these facts, Lansberg draws the amusing petty bourgeois moral of how unstable and irregular export trade is when it is bound up with loans. How bad it is to invest capital abroad instead of naturally and harmoniously developing home industry. How costly is the backsheesh that Krupp has to pay in floating foreign loans, etc. But the facts are clear. The increase in exports is closely connected with the swindling tricks of finance capital, which is not concerned with bourgeois morality, but with skinning the ox twice. First, it pockets the profits from the loan, then it pockets other profits from the same loan, which the borrower uses to make purchases from Krupp, or to purchase railway material from the steel syndicate, etc. We repeat that we do not by any means consider Lansberg's figures to be perfect, but we had to quote them because they are more scientific than Kautsky's inspectors, and because Lansberg showed the correct way of approaching the question. In discussing the significance of finance capital in regards to exports, etc., one must be able to single out of the connection of exports especially and solely with the tricks of the financiers, especially and solely with the sale of goods by cartels, etc. Simply to compare colonies with non-colonies, one imperialism with another imperialism, one semi-colony or colony, Egypt, with all other countries, is to evade and to tone down the very gist of the question. Kautsky's theoretical critique of imperialism has nothing in common with Marxism, and serves no other purpose than as a preamble to propaganda for peace and unity with the opportunists and the social chauvinists, precisely for the reason that it evades and obscures the very profound and radical contradictions of imperialism, the contradictions between monopoly and free competition that exists side by side with it, between the gigantic operations and gigantic profits of finance capital and honest trade on the free market, the contradictions between combines and trusts, on the one hand, and non-trustified industry on the other, etc. The notorious theory of ultra-imperialism, invented by Kautsky, is equally reactionary. Compare his arguments on this subject in 1915 with Hobson's arguments in 1902. Kautsky: whether the present imperialist policy cannot be supplanted by a new ultra-imperialist policy, which will introduce the joint exploitation of the world by internationally united finance capital in place of the mutual rivalries of national finance capital. Such a new phase of capitalism is, at any rate, conceivable. Can it be achieved? Sufficient premises are still lacking to enable us to answer this question. Hobson: Christendom thus laid out in a few great federal empires, each with a retinue of uncivilized dependencies, seems to many the most legitimate development of present tendencies and one which would offer the best hope of permanent peace on an assured basis of inter-imperialism. Kautsky called ultra-imperialism or super-imperialism what Hobson, 13 years earlier, had described as inter-imperialism. Except for coining a new and clever word by replacing one Latin prefix by another, the only progress Kautsky has made in the sphere of scientific thought is that he has labeled as Marxism that which Hobson, in effect, described as the cant of English parsons. After the Anglo-Boer War, it was quite natural that this worthy caste should exert every effort to console the British middle class and the workers who had lost many of their relatives on the battlefields of South Africa and who were obliged to pay higher taxes in order to guarantee still higher profits for the British financiers. And what better consolation could there be than the theory that imperialism is not so bad, that it stands close to inter- or ultra-imperialism, while it promises permanent peace? No matter what the good intentions of the British parsons, or of sentimental Kautsky, may have been, the only objective, i.e. real, social meaning Kautsky's theory can have is that it is a most reactionary method of consoling the masses with hopes of permanent peace being possible under capitalism, detracting their attention from the sharp antagonisms and acute problems of the present era, and directing it along illusory perspectives of an imaginary ultra-imperialism of the future. Deception of the masses. There is nothing but this in Kautsky's Marxian theory. Indeed, it is enough to compare well-known and indisputable facts to become convinced of the utter falsity of the prospects which Kautsky tries to conjure up before the German workers and the workers of all lands. Let us consider India, Indochina, and China. It is known that these three colonial and semi-colonial countries, inhabited by 600 to 700 million human beings, are subjected to the exploitation of the finance capital of several imperialist states: Great Britain, France, Japan, the USA, etc. We will presume that these imperialist countries form alliances against one another in order to protect and extend their possessions, their interests, and their spheres of influence in these Asiatic states. These alliances will be inter-imperialist or ultra-imperialist alliances. We will presume that all the imperialist countries conclude an alliance for the peaceful sharing out of these parts of Asia. This alliance would be an alliance of internationally unified finance capital. As a matter of fact, alliances of this kind have been made in the 20th century, notably with regard to China. We ask, is it conceivable, assuming that the capitalist system remains intact, and this is precisely the assumption that Kautsky does make, that such alliances would be more than temporary, that they would eliminate friction, conflicts, and struggle in all and every possible form? This question only requires stating clearly enough to make it impossible for any but a negative reply to be given, for there can be no other conceivable basis under capitalism for the sharing out of spheres of influence, of interests, of colonies, etc. That a calculation of the strength of the participants in the share out, their general economic, financial, military strength, etc., and the strength of these participants in the share out does not change to an equal degree, for under capitalism, the development of different undertakings, trusts, branches of industry, or countries cannot be even. Half a century ago, Germany was a miserable, insignificant country, as far as its capitalist strength was concerned, compared with the strength of England at the time. Japan was similarly insignificant compared with Russia. Is it conceivable that in 10 or 20 years' time, the relative strengths of the imperialist powers will have remained unchanged? absolutely inconceivable. Therefore, inter-imperialist or ultra-imperialist alliances in the realities of the capitalist system, and not in the banal Philistine fantasies of English Parsons or of the German Marxist Kautsky, no matter what form they may assume, whether of one imperialist coalition against another, or of a general alliance embracing